Morning. I'd like to start this morning by a little reading. This is from Dogen's Shogenzo. It's the introduction to a essay called Gyoji. Gyoji means continuous practice. On the great road of Buddha's ancestors, there is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained. It forms the circle of the way and is never cut off. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there's not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. This being so, continuous practice is undivided, not forced by you or others. The power of this continuous practice confirms you as well as others. It means your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. Although it may not be noticed by others or by yourself, it is so. Accordingly, by the continuous practice of all the Buddhas and ancestors, your practice is actualized and the great road opens up. By your continuous practice, the continuous practice of all Buddhas is actualized and the great road of all Buddhas opens up. Your continuous practice creates the circle of the way. By this practice, Buddha ancestors abide as Buddha ancestors, not abide as Buddhas, have Buddha mind, and have attained Buddha without cutting off. Because of this practice, there are the sun, the moon, and the stars. Because of this practice, there is the great earth and the open sky. Because of this practice, there is body, mind, and environment. Because of this practice, there are the four great elements and the five skandhas. Continuous practice is not necessarily something people in the world love, but it should be the true place of return for everyone. Because of the continuous practice of all Buddhas of the past, present, and future, all Buddhas of the past, present, and future are actualized. The effect of such sustained practice is sometimes not hidden. Therefore, there is practice. The effect is sometimes not apparent. Therefore, you may not see or hear or know it. Understand that although it may not be revealed, it is not hidden. As it is not divided by what is hidden, apparent, existent, or non-existent, you may not notice the causal conditions that lead you to be engaged in the practice that actualizes you at this very moment. The reason you do not see it is that becoming conscious of it is not anything special. Anything remarkable. Investigate in detail that it is so because the causal conditions, that is, our aspiration to practice, is no other than this continuous practice, although continuous practice is not limited by these causal conditions. And here we come to the point. Dogen now is like cutting right into it. He says, continuous practice that actualizes itself is no other than your continuous practice right now. The now of this practice is not originally possessed by the self. The now of this practice does not come or go, enter or depart. The word now does not exist before or after continuous practice. The moment when it's actualized is called now. This being so, your continuous practice of this day is a seed of all Buddhas and the practice of all Buddhas. All Buddhas are actualized and sustained by your continuous practice. I think I'm finished. A while ago, I talked about, it was from a koan, from an early koan, that everyday mind or ordinary mind is the way. Joshu asks, "What is the way?" Nonsense says, "Ordinary mind is the way." So this is kind of expanding on that theme a bit. We have this, what would you call it, this circumstance, this kind of gesture we're making, where we, what do we do? Some people, some teachers have called it a kind of setup. We set ourselves up in a certain situation called zazen, where we... You heard of it? Anyone familiar with that? We face a wall. We are still. We're quiet. We settle our body and mind. We come back to our body and mind. So that's our kind of work, our kind of activity, the gesture we're making right now together. Question that Dogen brings up in this fascicle is, can this be sustained? Can this be continuous? Can this be an expression of our whole life? Or rather, how can we make practice uninterrupted or sustained or imbued with all the aspects, all the conditions of our life? Is that possible? Or is it something that we do as an exception to the rest of our life? Anyway, I'm throwing that out as a question to you. What is continuous practice for us? Anyone?
I haven't been sitting much lately for a number of reasons, and other things are really good too, you know. I've come to appreciate living alone. I think that's practice in and of itself. And when I go to the Y and sit on, do these machines that people, you know,
the Stairmaster practice of the way, huh? The Stairmaster practice of the way?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, it's somewhat similar, quite similar in some ways to sitting in the Zendo. You walk in there, people don't say hello or anything for the moment, you know, they're just doing their thing, you know. And they'll do one machine, they'll get up and go do another machine, and it's a religious practice almost, you know. It's really nice in there, because you just go in there and you do something which is good for you, and you go away again. And I was thinking about the Zendo when I was in there, you know, thinking how many parts of so-called everyday life are like that, where people get together and do things and share something without sharing. That's enough.
It seems like we share something here when we practice. Although we don't say anything or do anything, it's not apparent from the outside that we're doing anything at all. Really, we're doing nothing. But we're doing nothing together in a particular way. Practice, as it's come down to us, the sitting practice is a yoga. It's not often spoken of this way, but the Buddha was a yogi. He had a yogic activity, a discipline, in other words. So the question is, for me, in my history in practice, or my experience in practice, there's been times when I've expected the practice to kind of take care of me. I've expected it to happen in and of itself. And then there's other times when I've expected it to, when I've had to forcefully engage the practice. I invoke the practice. In other words, choose to sit down. Choose to be present. Kind of like our experience, I've used this metaphor before, our experience of, when we get on a train or we get on a bus, someone else is driving, right? We just get on and we go for a ride. I mean, I've had a view in some of my history with this way of expecting of the practice to take care of me, to actually take me for a ride, to actually do the work. And there's other times when I've been very conscious of actually choosing to, say, sit down, or notice my breath, or notice the functioning of my mind. Has anyone else had those two sides of the practice functioning in that? Yeah.
I sort of acknowledge continuous practice is a practice ideal in some sense, and I acknowledge that it's what should be happening. But it's hard to see it when drinking a glass of wine and watching television or getting excited on a sports contest or a thousand other things that I do pass the time, just deciding what to do next. Seems like I'm distracting myself continuously. So that's one aspect. And the other aspect is, if you have any expectations at all, Isn't that sort of a violation of practice? As opposed to just being there, practicing?
There's a kind of pure understanding of practice that's free of any expectations, of any gaining idea. Yes.
It's kind of a response to what Cliff was saying. I was wondering if what Dogen is pointing at is this continuous practice. To what degree is that a choice that a person makes? And to what degree is it not a choice, but just an ongoing process, in the sense that we don't really have a choice about being engaged with the world? We're here and we'll be engaged with the world whether we're distracting ourselves by watching soccer or
staring at a wall.
We're still here and engaged. And I wonder whether this continuous practice Dogen's referring to describes something that's unavoidable. It's not a choice because we are here and we're in it. And to what extent he's referring to the specific choice that we make in terms of choosing a certain behavior.
The word choice in Sanskrit is kind of a more expansive word. It's chetana, and it not only means choice. It not only gets translated as choice, but it means to avow, to actually make a vow. It means to have an aspiration. Or an intention to do something, or to be something, or to even exist. So chetana, choice is very interesting because when we're not on the bus or we're not on the train, we're driving, right? We have to steer. We get into our, this is my vehicle here, you know? And I have this steering wheel. It's called Hokkai Jōin. It's cosmic mudra. It's like, and I have to steer my way 40 minutes or so. In other words, I have to take, this is how the practice is presented, that we have to take complete responsibility for this activity. We choose to sit down, and we choose to be with our body and mind. We choose to be quiet. We choose to be still. And when it's finished, we choose to get up. We also choose that. There's this phrase called coming to our senses. We say, I don't know if we use it too much, but when we come to our senses, we sort of come to wake up a little bit, wake up to what's actually happening, come to your senses. So, also considering consciousness itself a kind of sense. Coming to our senses in practice is coming to body and mind. We have this, a sensorium is our field of our senses. That's our domain. There's also this term frequency domain to some of the senses. So that's a scientific term too, right? Yeah. So we have this, in other words, we have this equipment to for continuous practice. We have this sense, we have this material, this equipment to work with. And what is it? It's not necessarily constructed or fabricated reality, in other words, like what we thought of, or what we've construed, or what has been made up or theorized. It's more, that's too rich, you could say. That's too gorgeous. We actually go back into a simpler or more local space where we're actually working with just what is here. So, what is here? We sit down and we say, body and mind are here. Or we we have this kind of cue of noticing our body and mind by attending an object or focus of meditation. Is anyone familiar with this? It's called the breath. Has anyone experienced their breath in meditation? Please raise your hands. So with our inhalation, noticing our breath, say choosing this specific topic or object of meditation, we with our inhalation we receive air, we receive, and with our exhalation, we release. Receive and release, receive and release. That's our kind of working in space in meditation, at least initially. The question is, can we continue? Or does it continue? Does it continue by itself? I mean, the inquiry that I make to myself is, most of the time, like you talked about, Cliff, is most of my recognition outside of this circumstance is noticing when I'm not practicing. I notice that. Have you noticed when you're not practicing outside of meditation? Mm-hmm. Never?
Mm-hmm. If you notice, you're practicing.
Right. There you go.
That's good.
That's true. When you notice you're not practicing, you're practicing. Why is it that when you notice that you're not practicing, you're practicing?
Why? You answer it.
Some of us have a built-in devil that sees that we're not practicing our judgment, and it.
The practice is usually, in a classical sense, it's. It's described as kind of two wings or two attributes. So there's shamatha and there's vipassana. Shamatha and vipassana. Shamatha means to settle, to calm, to rest with or rest on, to fix or to be with. That's shamatha. And noticing our breath or being with our breath is sometimes correlated with shamatha. And vipassana means to be present, to be awake, to awake in the sense of like alert, to know what's going on. It can include a discursive thought as well. It's also equated with mindfulness, being mindful. So shamatha and vipassana are these two wings of meditation. And the way it's described classically is like these two wings have to be in balance. So if you're involved too much in calming, settling, pacifying, that's not the whole picture. You'll sink, in a sense, into a kind of lethargic state, or a dream state, or maybe you could call it a trance. You'll sink below what's actually happening. And if you're too involved in vipassana, in thinking, or you'll get too excited. You'll kind of miss things because you'll be moving too fast, or you'll be overlaying what's actually happening with too much mental energy or discursive energy. So proper practice is the balance of those two things together. Traditionally, too, shamatha has nine stages. And the first stage, this might be interesting. The first stage is called fixing, or placing, or resting the mind. That's the first stage. Just actually finding the object of meditation, like check in with your breath when you sit down. The second stage is extended fixation. In other words, you've done it and you do it again or you do it a little longer. The third stage is called refixing or resetting. In other words, you've lost your concentration, you've lost your object of meditation, and now you're coming back. The fourth stage is close settling or resting near. This is where it's a little more intimate and contained, and you're with it. You're at rest with it. Fifth stage is called taming or discipline, choshin in Japanese. It's tamed. In other words, like the ox pictures, it's pliable, you know? You're working with it. It's your friend. This whole process is your friend, and you have this friendly relationship with it. And the sixth, which relates to it, is pacifying. You adjust that with discipline, with attention. The seventh stage is an introspective stage where you reflect back on the meditation. This is very analytical, so this is not often talked about in Zen in this way. The eighth stage, though, is called joyous effort. This is interesting. It's called joyous effort. In other words, at this stage in shamatha, you are not... there's no problem about staying with the object of meditation. The object of meditation is stable, and you're staying with your breath, or you're just present. If even if you're not aware of your breath, if you're just present. And it's joyful, it's pleasant, and it's refreshing. And the final stage, the ninth stage, is called spontaneous engagement. In other words, there's in this final stage of shamatha, and all these stages are related and kind of all contained in the experience. In spontaneous engagement, there's no effort. There's no effort whatsoever. Zazen, you probably heard this statement before. Zazen sits zazen. You don't sit zazen. Zazen is taking care of zazen. You're not separate from the experience. It's not you applying effort to meditate. Meditation itself is coming forward and confirming you. Meditation itself is not this or that or the other thing. It's simply the arising of all dharmas. Every dharma, in other words, every experience, every event, every thought, even if it's a distracting thought, is confirming and sustaining the way. And that's continuous practice. And what Dogen is saying in this fascicle is he's saying, this is going on, whether you know it or not. This is functioning, whether me with my small mind are saying we're making an effort. But background of that is it is coming to meet you. It is sustaining you.
Technically, but we haven't heard about.
It seems like Dogen is trying to contrast continuous practice with more the notion of, you know, like exutory or like some sort of a experience you want to hold on to.
Yeah.
Where there's like a separation. I mean, this dialectic he uses in all of his fascicles, it seems like that, you know, there's no such thing as you sit, you meditate, you get enlightened, and that's this state.
Like step one, you sit down, step
right.
Two, yeah.
But I was always thinking that there's something about aspiration. I mean, the part of aspiration is a little confusing to me after listening to this. Like, how does that relate to, like, having no object of practice? Like, in Shikantaza, he talks about impure practice where you even drop any aspiration. But he also talks about aspiration here. It's a little, you know, he's basically saying that even drop that. So is it like something where you start off and then you kind of let go, or?
Did you start off with an aspiration,
right,
and then the aspiration itself falls away?
Right.
Not, I wouldn't say the aspiration itself falls away, but the attachment or identification to the aspiration falls away. So, the word aspiration means to aspire, it means to breathe, actually, to be with breath, oddly enough, you know, which is what we do. We aspire toward breath, means to be toward breath, to come toward breath. So aspiration means to come, to meet something, to come forward, or to join or to come forward to meet something. There's a Dzogchen teaching that might shed light on this. In the Dzogchen tradition, just like the Shikantaza tradition, there's a sense of a anytime there's a tendency to fixate on an object of meditation as a sense of isolating it from the rest of the experience, that's cut away. So there's always a view of expanding that and being very inclusive, including everything as a meditative experience. Wait a few more minutes. At times it happens that some meditators say that this is difficult to recognize the nature of mind. It's not at all difficult. The fault lies in not knowing how to meditate. This is a Dzogchen teacher speaking. One does not need to search for meditation. One doesn't have to buy it, cultivate it, or go somewhere else for it. One does not need to do any work. It's sufficient simply to let your mind rest in the state of whatever takes place and whatever happens. To rest in the state of whatever takes place, whatever happens. There are some meditators who don't let their mind rest in itself as one should. Instead, they let it watch outwardly or search inwardly as one shouldn't. You should neither see nor find the mind by watching outwardly or searching inwardly. This is really radical. The fault lies in not having understood the real meaning. There's no reason whatsoever to watch outwardly or search inwardly. Let go directly into the mind that is watching outwardly or searching inwardly. And that is exactly it. In other words, like, whatever is happening, whether that is the object of meditation. Whatever is noticing, like Judy said, when you notice, when you remember that you're not meditating, you're meditating. When you're in, as a teacher once said, when you're in Macy's and you realize that it's time for meditation and you've lost all track of time, you're actually there meditating with everyone who's practicing, even though you're in Macy's shopping. I'd like to read, there's much more to talk about on this topic. I think it's a very big topic. How to extend our practice into the bells of lunch.
That's just the kids, they love to ring the bell.
Oh yeah, that's right.
I'm sorry. He's hungry.
Yeah. And how to extend it into our daily life. Without it being an assignment or a project or a kind of or a bell mantra, yeah. So please take this question with you: how to extend the practice and. I'd like to just close with a little more of Dogen. This is from the Genjo Koan, and he's kind of wrapping up the whole Genjo Koan with these words. He's just use the metaphor of the bird or the fish, if you remember that section in the Genjo Koan, the bird being related to the sky and being connected to the sky, and the bird and the sky being one, and the fish and the water being one. That life is not just bird, not just sky, but bird and sky together. Then he says, like the bird and like the fish, we manifest in our places before extending further. So there's just the arrival at this place, and with that arrival, everyday activity is the manifestation. Everyday activity is the manifestation of absolute reality. The way is ordinary activity that actualizes all things. The way, the place, is not large or small, not self, not other, not from before, and not newly emerging. It is just this. The Buddha way is in engaging one Dharma. There is the completion of one Dharma. And within one activity, the completion of all activities. So here is the place, and it is here that the way opens. With no distinct boundaries to realization, simultaneously knowing and not knowing come forward, and simultaneously we practice with Buddha as Buddha. Realization is not an acquisition, and it is not to be grasped as an object of knowledge, and not necessarily even manifest, yet it is always and immediately right here before us.